These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. These lectures are titled, The Long Shadow of the Ancient Greek World, Part 2. Lecture 13. Sparta, the odd man outstate in Greece.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. After our broad survey of Athenian history and society in the last lectures, we return to the Archaic period and to what will be the other superpower of the classical period, Sparta. As I said at the end of the last lecture, we can't study Greek history or Athenian imperialism in any detail without knowing about the Spartans. Now, I call Sparta the odd man out state in Greece because it was so different from any other polis. Moreover, the other Greeks seemed to think it was different too. They both admired and detested the Spartans at the same time because of the lifestyle of the people and a system of brutal military training that was at the heart of their society to produce the best soldiers in the Greek world. In this and the next 2.5 lectures, we're going to look at various aspects of Spartan history and society, beginning in this lecture with some general observations about Sparta and then an examination of its constitution. Sparta was located in the area of the Peloponnese called Laconia, and its people were of the Dorian race. These Dorians had migrated into Greece and down to the Peloponnese towards the end of the Bronze Age period. They came from the north, and indeed there's one theory that the Dorians might have brought about the collapse of Bronze Age civilization. What we do know is that the Dorians seem to have ridden roughshod over the native populations in the regions in which they settled. In the case of Sparta, for example, we find a group of people living around the city of Sparta throughout Sparta's history, and this group was called the Perioikoi. The Perioikoi is a Greek word that means something like dwellers around or dwellers about. Exactly who the Perioikoi were is unknown, but the most plausible explanation is that they were the original inhabitants of Sparta and the surrounding areas before the Dorian invasion. And then when these Dorians arrived in the Peloponnese, they displaced the original inhabitants from Sparta and those areas and set up shop there themselves. The original inhabitants, though, continued living close by or dwelt around Sparta, occupying themselves as farmers or craftsmen. So this would be a good example then of the Dorians displacing the native population and giving them a new name in the process, Perioikoi. The Perioikoi, as far as Sparta was concerned, were not citizens, but they were required to fight in the Spartan army. And when that happened, they were formed into their own ethnic unit under a Spartan general. Sparta is a difficult place to study, not only because of the dearth of literary evidence from Sparta and the general character of the people, but also because of how ancient writers pictured the Spartans. Our two chief sources are the 4th century writer Xenophon, along with Plutarch, who was the biographer in the Roman Republican period, writing those series of biographies of Greeks and Romans. We also have additional information about Sparta from Plato, but in these lectures, I'm pretty much going on what Xenophon and Plutarch have to tell us. In an age where polis were suffering civil strife, some of them even tyranny, as we've seen, the Spartans seem to be above all this. To outsiders, then, they seemed to have an organized society. They didn't endure a tyranny. And in this society, everyone was equal and adhered to the laws. there was this technical term homoioi, meaning equals. The Spartans were also seen as patriotic, and they were focused on a unique social system to produce physically fit citizens, even women, who put maximum store on bravery. And Spartan men were brought up to fight and die for the state and not think twice about it. As a result of these outsiders looking in on Sparta, the term Spartan mirage is often applied to Sparta. And subsequent peoples and cultures have evoked Sparta for their own means. By subsequent cultures and peoples, I mean anybody from the American founding fathers to the totalitarianism of Nazi Germany. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Spartans might have lived in an ordered society, but it was just as chaotic as anywhere else. And in refusing to develop artistically and especially economically like other polis, they created all sorts of problems for themselves, especially when they got involved elsewhere. In other words, especially when they got involved outside of the Peloponnese. So this Spartan mirage comes about because writers think that Sparta is different from other polis in the sense that it had a more ordered society. It didn't endure strife. And as a result, they've distorted history. In fact, to make matters worse for the Spartans, as we shall see, they suffered the same land hunger problems as the other polis were doing. But instead of sending out colonies or anything like that, as other Greek states were doing, they solved their land hunger problems by annexing neighboring territory and enslaving the population. They created, in the process, a massive Achilles heel for themselves that no other state suffered. The Spartans would come to boast the most formidable land army in Greece until the Macedonian army under Philip II in the mid-4th century. Sparta, as I said, became one of the superpowers of the Greek world in the classical period. It headed a powerful empire called the Peloponnesian League, which defeated Athens in the Peloponnesian War and imposed its hegemony over the Greeks for a few decades after that. Yet despite the Spartans' power and influence in the Greek world, and despite the fact that they eventually came to control 2/5 of the Peloponnese, that's the areas of Laconia and Messenia, the city of Sparta itself was devoid of magnificent buildings, temples, and things like that. Now this was a startling contrast to a place like Athens, and ancient writers commented on this as well. According to Thucydides, if Sparta suddenly became deserted and only its buildings were left, he says that, and I quote here, future generations would hardly believe that the city in reality had been as powerful as it was. And Thucydides goes on to say that if Athens suffered the same fate, in other words, if suddenly everybody disappeared and only the buildings were left, then Thucydides says, you would think, from what you saw, that the city, that's Athens, was in fact twice as powerful as it really was. You can see then how we get the adjective Spartan from Sparta to denote anything that's austere, without frills, frugal. The Spartan lifestyle was without frills. The city of Sparta was not magnificent. It was plain. Many years ago, when I was in Australia actually, I took a study tour to Greece. We went all over the place in three and a half weeks or so. One of the places we went to was Sparta. And I took the students and the other people that came with us, wasn't just students, took them into the middle of this field in old Sparta. And they said, okay, well, take us to the site of Sparta now. Take us to where we can see the original place that, you know, Leonidas came from and that was the center of the Peloponnesian League. And I said, you're standing in it. And here we were in the middle of a field, just sort of cows mooing over there and a few lumps of rock and stones and stuff. And that's Sparta, because there weren't any buildings. Any remains today date from the later Hellenistic and Roman periods. And it's very startling. It really brings home to you that when you're standing in the middle of a field with cows around you, that the Spartans really were Spartan. Let's now turn to look at Sparta in more detail. Sparta was originally founded when four small villages combined together. Later, it absorbed the town of Amyclae, about 3 or 4 miles to its south. And by the 8th century BC, it had taken over all of Laconia. So Sparta became the polis of Laconia. Now, during the Dark Ages, the reign of a single king ended. So in the Bronze Age period, Sparta was governed by a king, just like every other Bronze Age palace center. The Spartan king, the most famous Spartan king was Menelaus, of course, whose wife Helen was abducted by the Trojans. During the Dark Age period, as I said, the reign of a single king came to an end and power fell into the hands of noble families, just as was the case in other polis. But as we'll see, Sparta decided to be different even then. The Spartans got rid of the single king, but they replaced him with two kings. So during this period then, during the Dark Ages and tracking into the Archaic, Sparta was developing just like any other polis. It produced fine Laconian pottery, furniture, wine, and Spartan poets also wrote pretty good poems. We have fragments from the Spartan poet Tyrtaeus, for example. They're a bit different because they have these two kings, but apart from that, Sparta is developing just like any other place. Then all of a sudden, wham, this just stopped. The Spartans stopped developing economically, culturally, like the other polis were in the Archaic period, and they developed a unique political and social system. And this system excluded all luxury comforts, everything you can think of that might have frills attached to it. And these political and social developments were bound up with a man called Lycurgus, the legendary Spartan lawgiver. Lycurgus was to Sparta what Solon was to Athens. Now, it seems that Lycurgus brought a decree from the Oracle of Apollo at Delphi, which redefined or reformed the Spartan political structure. It became a mixture of monarchy, oligarchy, and democracy. So this immediately sets it aside from other polis that we know about. Now, we've got a problem with Lycurgus, because while we know that Solon certainly existed, we can't say the same for Lycurgus. He may have been a mythical figure invented by the Spartans later on in life to explain the origins of their constitution and their society. Now, this is not all that far-fetched when you consider that the Romans did much the same thing about their origins. Wealthy Roman families, quite late on in the Republic, patronized writers like Livy to describe the early history of Rome. And in the process, in return for paying him, they wanted their families elevated in the early history of Rome. In other words, these writers elevated the influence of these aristocratic families. That's why we have to take what we know about early Rome with a big pinch of salt. The same is true of Lycurgus. He may not have existed. If he did, we don't know when he was alive. Arguments range from the mid-9th century as late as the 7th century. Nowadays, the tendency is to place Lycurgus later, in the late 8th century or the early 7th century BC. What we can say, though, is that if he did exist, he didn't do everything that's been attributed to him. Like Solon, he started off a process of change, and others completed that process. Now, support is given. This is not a novel idea. It's not as if you're hearing something astonishingly new right now. And we know that he started off the process and others added to it because later on in time, a rider, like an amendment, was added to the decree that he brought back from Delphi that redefined the Spartan constitution. This rider diminished the power of the Spartan assembly. So obviously a rider is a later addition. By the end of the 7th century, though, I think we were on reasonably safe ground for saying that the political and social system of Sparta had fully come into being. Now, the decree about the Spartan constitution, the one that Lycurgus brought back from Delphi, was called the Great Rhetora. Rhetora is just the Greek word for decree, sometimes constitution. Amazingly, the Rhetora is quoted in Plutarch's Life of Lycurgus. So, as with Solon's poetry, history comes alive again. And this is what Plutarch quotes. I'm going to read out now the Rhetora as it's contained in Plutarch's Life of Lycurgus. Here we go. When you have dedicated a temple to Zeus Solanius and Athena Solania, arrange the people into phile and obey, and established a gerousia of 30 men, including the Archegetae, then from time to time, apolatsane between Babica and Kanakion, in order to propose and do away with measures. But decisions and power are to lie with the people. Well, this might describe the machinery of the constitution, but what does it mean? Well, let's break it down. The Spartans were first to be divided into various groups. This is what phile and obe means, like tribes in a way. And their constitution was made up of a combination of monarchic, aristocratic and democratic elements. That's what's meant by gerousia. This was a council of elders that included the two kings. The kings are referred to in the Rhetora as the Archegetae. And there was also to be an assembly, and it was called the Appella. And this is from the Greek verb to hold an assembly. So we have three organs of the Spartan constitution in the Appella. We have the kingship, the gerousia, which includes the two kings, and we have the Appella, the assembly. Now, according to the Rhetora, this Appella was to meet regularly by the look of it. In fact, it would meet once a month or so when the moon was full. Meetings were to be held between Babica, which was apparently a bridge, and Kanakion, which was a river. In other words, the Appella, the assembly, met outside, just like the Athenian assembly did. This is deliberate, though, because according to Plutarch, Lycurgus believed that if you met inside an elaborately decorated room with statues and paintings on its walls and ceilings and stuff like that, if you met in a sort of Sistine Chapel type of environment, you wouldn't focus on the business in hand. You'd be too distracted looking around at everything. And think about such a place today. If you were in a Sistine Chapel or in something like that, or even a beautifully decorated theatre, you couldn't help but look around and lose track at times of the business in hand. So Lycurgus wanted the Appella to meet outside because the people could only look at, be focused on the business in hand. The place where the Appella met was obviously one that everybody knew of. It's between this bridge and the river. So it's no different from today, where we might arrange to meet someone under the clock in a railway station or something like that. So here's the Rhetora again. When you have dedicated a temple to Zeus Solanius and Athena Solania, arrange the people into phile and obe, and established a gerousia of 30 men, including the Archegetae, then from time to time apolatsane between Babica and Kanakion, in order to propose and do away with measures or something like that. But decisions and power are to lie with the people. For some reason, Sparta retained the kingship, as I said, and this made it different from other polis. Although, from the Rhetora, we see that there was a dual monarchy, two kings. The king's powers were not absolute. They were members of the gerousia, which means that the other members of the gerousia might have had some sort of check on the power of the kings. So the kings are not absolute rulers, as they were during the Bronze Age. At the same time, these kings were not just figureheads. They had some judicial powers. They had some religious functions. They may well have been akin to chief priests. They may have made public sacrifices on behalf of the state. We know they did this later on. But most importantly, they were the commanders of the army, and they were expected to lead it in battle and set an example to the troops. Whether they could exert any influence in the Gerousia because of their status, because of the fact that they were kings, is unknown. But their influence in the state was shown, as I said, by their having to lead by example. It was expected that the kings would fight bravely in battle and set the right example for everyone to follow. And this is one reason, you know, perhaps it's the reason, why Leonidas, the Spartan king, stood firm in 480 against the Persians at Thermopylae, and despite being massively outnumbered, he and the famous 300 Spartans fought to the end. Because if they hadn't, if Leonidas had gone back home to fight another day, he wouldn't have lived up to the expectation of being a Spartan king. Why there were two kings is not properly known. The Spartans were traditionalists to an extent. They might not have wanted to get rid of the kingship, as other states did. They might have wanted to maintain this continuity with the Bronze Age. We sort of can argue that the Athenians did the same thing because they have the Archon Basileus. And the word Basileus means king. It's some continuity from the Bronze Age. But the Archon Basileus was not a king, whereas the Spartans did have kings. But it doesn't explain why there were two and not just one. The most plausible explanation, the one that's commonly accepted, is that one king would lead the army into battle, one king would leave Sparta on campaign, that is, while the other one stayed behind. He stayed behind to play a role in civic affairs, but more importantly, he stayed there to ensure continuity if the other king were killed in battle. Another explanation, we can't disregard this one, is that these two kings always came from the same two families. So perhaps there was a dispute at the end of the Bronze Age between two super aristocratic families, two, you know, highest of the high. And this dispute was over which one would furnish a king, where the king should come from. And when this dispute couldn't be resolved, these two families struck a compromise. And they said, okay, let's forget it. Let's just have two kings, one from each of our families. Boom. Simple, and it makes sense. The Gerousia, the other organ in the Spartan constitution in this period, the Gerousia, or the Council of Elders, as it's usually translated, was a body of 30 men. It was made up of, as I said, the two kings who were there ex officio, and then 28 nobles who had to be over the age of 60, and they held office for life. Now, since only nobles could become members of the Gerousia, the body was obviously aristocratic in composition. So it's a bit like the Areopagus in Athens, isn't it? The Gerousia prepared the agenda for the assembly, and it introduced matters to be discussed. But this couldn't happen. The appella could not vote until the members of the Gerousia had debated the agenda items, and issued their own reactions. The Gerousia also had some judicial functions. These included hearing cases of homicide and treason, which carried with them the death penalty. So these were serious, and therefore the serious council heard them. The process of election to the Gerousia is interesting. Plutarch tells us that when one of its members died, the people were brought together in an appella to elect the successor. The candidates paraded themselves before the people, and as they did so, the people shouted for each one. And the one who received the loudest shout won. Finally, our third organ in the Spartan constitution, as described in the Rhetoric, that is, the assembly, the appella. Now, the appella was open to full male citizens over the age of 30, who were known as Spartiates. I say full citizens, because only those who had successfully completed the system of military training, that's called the agoge, and we're going to be focusing on that a lot in the next lecture, only those who had survived, literally, because many died during the process, those who had survived the agoge and also kept up their membership of the barracks in which they'd lived during their time in the agoge, Only those were full citizens, and they were called Spartiates. If someone didn't graduate from the agoge, or couldn't keep up his membership of his barracks, then he was known as an inferior, sometimes translated as a trembler. And he didn't have the same political and judicial rights as the Spartiates. So you can have Spartiates, full Spartan citizens, and then you can have Spartans, who are tremblers, inferiors. When I'm talking about Spartans, I generally mean the full citizens. There was still equality, though. Even though you got Spartiates and tremblers or inferiors, there's still equality in the sense that a citizen, a Spartan citizen, could not be sold into slavery by another citizen. They were all homoioi. And that wasn't the case, as we've seen, in pre-Solonian Attica. Now, the appeller had no right of debate. The people voted yes or no to a particular proposal put by the gerousia, and decisions were made by shouting. Again, we note the shouting element, something that Aristotle thought was very puerile. So we have the mixed constitution, monarchy, oligarchy, and democracy. And there's an addition to this as time goes on. At some point, a rider was added to the retra by kings Polydorus and Theopompus. And this rider muzzled the political power of the appeller. Plutarch also quotes the rider, "If the people should make a crooked decision, the elders and the archegetai, that's the kings, should discount it." In other words, if the people in the appella voted in a way that the gerousia didn't like, that was what was meant by voting in a crooked manner, then the gerousia could render that decision null and void. Now, we don't know when or why the rider was introduced, other than Plutarch saying that the appella had been messing around with proposals for quite some time. So evidently, the gerousia had got tired of this and decided enough was enough. It's interesting how the rider was passed, because we think that the people would be absolutely against it. It's a way of muzzling their power in the state. Well, Plutarch goes on to quote a few lines from the poet Tyrtaeus, and he tells us that these two kings, Polydorus and Theopompus, brought the rider from Delphi. And he goes on to say that these two kings said that Apollo was saying only the gerousia and the kings were to rule Sparta. So this is another nice example of the political exploitation of religion. How could the people not accept the rider and not vote in accordance with the gerousia's wishes when Apollo had said, this is the way it has to be? Now, one other addition to the Spartan constitution, and this isn't mentioned in the retra, is the introduction of the ephorate. Every year, the appella elected 5 ephors, or overseers. Now, these men had to be over the age of 30. They served for 1 year. Re-election was not possible. One of them was the eponymous ephor. He gave his name to the year, just like the eponymous archon in Athens. Now, the ephorate was another democratic feature of the constitution, although when it was added is unknown. But obviously it's later than the retra because there's no mention of it in the retra. The office seems to have had something to do with the kings, as the ephors had a monitoring duty over them. For example, two of the ephors always went with a king when he left on campaign to monitor his activities. Now, we'll be talking about the ephors more as we go on in our lectures, but that's really all I want to say about them now, other than to say that they would eventually acquire a lot of power in the state, in Sparta. I want to finish this lecture now by making some comparisons and contrasts between the Athenian and the Spartan constitutions. You've probably been thinking about this already. It's pretty clear that Sparta is an oligarchy given the power that the gerousia wields. It has the power to render a decision of the appella null and void. This sort of thing could not happen in Athens. I said earlier that the gerousia looks very similar to the Areopagus. It is aristocratic councils held office for life. But the Areopagus didn't introduce the agenda to the ecclesia, the Athenian assembly, and the Areopagus didn't issue resolutions, and the Areopagus certainly couldn't overturn a decision of the Ecclesia. The Gerousia could, as far as the Appella went. Perhaps the biggest difference in these constitutions, aside from the fact there's a dual monarchy, is the rights and powers of the assemblies. In Sparta, the Spartan assembly, the Appella, didn't have the right to debate. All it could do was vote yes or no to a proposal. It did so by shouting. And its decision could be overturned. In Athens, the Ecclesia, the name for the Athenian assembly, did have the right to debate. It voted by a show of hands, and however it voted, whether it was yes or no to a proposal, could not be overturned. But it's not just this mixed constitution that makes the Spartans different from the other Greeks. It's also their system of military education and how their society was organized. It's these aspects that we're going to discuss in our next lectures. And in the next one, let's just find out how brutal the Agoge really was. Thank you very much.